I am literally a few yards from the door of the cement house when I pull up short. And that's not because of the smoke, or the prints, or the smell. That's because of the unmistakable click of a weapon behind me. Second nature, instinct. I turn, drawing back the arrow, although I know already that the odds are not in my favor. I see the white peacekeeper uniform, the pointed chin, the light brown iris where my arrow will find a home. But the weapon is dropping to the ground, and the unarmed woman is holding something out to me in her gloved hand. Stop! She cries. I waver, unable to process this turn in events. Perhaps they have orders to bring me in alive, so they can torture me into incriminating every person I ever knew. Yeah, good luck with that, I think. My fingers have all but decided to release the arrow when I see the object in the glove. It's a small white circle of flat bread. More of a cracker, really, gray and soggy around the edges. But an image is clearly stamped in the center of it. It's my mockingjay. Part 2. The Quell. Chapter 10. It makes no sense. My bird baked into bread. Unlike the stylish renderings I saw in the Capitol, this is definitely not a fashion statement. What is it? What does that mean? I ask harshly, still prepared to kill. It means we're on your side, says a tremulous voice behind me. I didn't see her when I came up. She must have been in the house. I don't take my eyes off my current target. Probably the newcomer is armed, but I'm betting she won't risk letting me hear the click that would mean my death was imminent, knowing I would instantly kill her companion. Come around where I can see you, I order. She can't. She's... begins the woman with the cracker. Come around, I shout. There's a step and a dragging sound. I can hear the effort the movement requires. Another woman, or maybe I should call her a girl, since she looks about my age, limps into view. She's dressed in an ill-fitting peacekeeper's uniform, complete with the white fur cloak, but it's several sizes too large for her slight frame. She carries no visible weapon. Her hands are occupied with steadying a rough crutch made from a broken branch. The toe of her right boot can't clear the snow, hence the dragging. I examine the girl's face, which is bright red from the cold. Her teeth are crooked, and there's a strawberry birthmark over one of her chocolate brown eyes. This is no peacekeeper, no citizen of the capital either. Who are you? I ask warily, but less belligerently. My name's Twill, says the woman. She's older, maybe 35 or so. And this is Bonnie. We've run away from District 8. District 8? Then they must know about the uprising. Where'd you get the uniforms? I ask.
I stole them from the factory, says Bonnie. We make them there, only I thought this one would be for someone else. That's why it fits so poorly.
The gun came from a dead peacekeeper, says Twill, following my eyes. That cracker in your hand, with the bird. What's that about? I ask.
Don't you know Katniss?
Bonnie appears genuinely surprised. They recognize me. Of course they recognize me. My face is uncovered, and I'm standing here outside of District 12 pointing an arrow at them. Who else would I be? I know it matches the pin I wore in the arena.
She doesn't know, says Bonnie softly. Maybe not about any of it.
Suddenly I feel the need to appear on top of things. I know you had an uprising in 8.
Yes, that's why we had to get out, says Twill.
Well, you're good and out now. What are you going to do? I ask.
We're headed for District 13, Twill replies.
13?
I say. There's no 13. It got blown off the map.
75 years ago, says Twill. Bonnie shifts on her crutch and winces.
What's wrong with your leg? I ask.
I twisted my ankle. My boots are too big, says Bonnie.
I bite my lip. My instinct tells me they're telling the truth, and behind that truth is a whole lot of information I'd like to get. I step forward and retrieve Twill's gun before lowering my bow, though. Then I hesitate a moment, thinking of another day in this woods when Gale and I watched a hovercraft appear out of thin air and capture two escapees from the capital. The boy was speared and killed. The red-headed girl, I found out when I went to the capital, was mutilated and turned into a mute servant called an Avox.
Anyone after you?
We don't think so. We think they believe we were killed in a factory explosion, says Twill.
Only a fluke that we weren't.
All right, let's go inside, I say, nodding at the cement house. I follow them in, carrying the gun. Bonnie makes straight for the hearth and lowers herself onto a peacekeeper's cloak that has been spread before it. She holds her hands to the feeble flame that burns on one end of a charred log. Her skin is so pale as to be translucent, and I can see the fire glow through her flesh. Twill tries to arrange the cloak, which must have been her own, around the shivering girl. A 10-gallon can has been cut in half, the lip ragged and dangerous. It sits in the ashes, filled with a handful of pine needles steaming in water.
Making tea? I ask.
We're not sure, really. I remember seeing someone do this with pine needles on the Hunger Games a few years back. At least, I think it was pine needles, says Twill with a frown. I remember District 8, an ugly urban place, stinking of industrial fumes, the people housed in run-down tenements, barely a blade of grass in sight, no opportunity ever to learn the ways of nature. It's a miracle these two have made it this far.
Out of food? I ask.
Bonnie nods.
We took what we could, but food's been so scarce. That's been gone for a while.
The quaver in her voice melts my remaining defenses. She is just a malnourished, injured girl fleeing the capital.
Well, then this is your lucky day, I say, dropping my game bag on the floor.
People are starving all over the district, and we still have more than enough. So I've been spreading things around a little. I have my own priorities. Gale's family, Greasy Say, some of the other Hob traders who were shut down. My mother has other people, patients mostly, who she wants to help. This morning I purposely overstuffed my game bag with food, knowing my mother would see the depleted pantry and assume I was making my rounds to the hungry. I was actually buying time to go to the lake without her worrying. I intended to deliver the food this evening on my return, but now I can see that won't be happening. From the bag, I pull two fresh buns with a layer of cheese baked into the top. We always seem to have a supply of these since Peter found out they were my favorite. I toss one to Twill, but cross over and place the other on Bonnie's lap, since her hand-eye coordination seems a little questionable at the moment, and I don't want the thing ending up in the fire.
Oh, says Bonnie. Oh, is this all for me?
Something inside me twists as I remember another voice. Rue, in the arena, when I gave her the leg of Grusling.
Oh, I've never had a whole leg to myself before.
The disbelief of the chronically hungry.
Yeah,
eat up, I say. Bonnie holds the bun as if she can't quite believe it's real, and then sinks her teeth into it again and again, unable to stop. It's better if you chew it. She nods, trying to slow down, but I know how hard it is when you're that hollow. I think your tea's done. I scoot the tin can from the ashes.
Twill finds 2 tin cups in her pack, and I dip out the tea, setting it on the floor to cool. They huddle together, eating, blowing on their tea, and taking tiny scalding sips as I build up the fire. I wait until they are sucking the grease from their fingers to ask, "So, what's your story?" And they tell me. Ever since the Hunger Games, the discontent in District 8 had been growing. It was always there, of course, to some degree, but what differed was that talk was no longer sufficient, and the idea of taking action went from a wish to a reality. The textile factories at Service Panem are loud with machinery, and the din also allowed word to pass safely. A pair of lips close to an ear, words unnoticed, unchecked. Twill taught at school. Bonnie was one of her pupils, and when the final bell had rung, both of them spent a 4-hour shift at the factory that specialized in the peacekeeper uniforms. It took months for Bonnie, who worked in the chilly inspection dock, to secure the 2 uniforms, a boot here, a pair of pants there. They were intended for Twill and her husband because it was understood that once the uprising began, it would be crucial to get word of it out beyond District 8 if it were to spread and be successful. The day Peeta and I came through and made our victory tour appearance was actually a rehearsal of sorts. People in the crowd positioned themselves according to their teams, next to the buildings they would target when the rebellion broke out. That was the plan. To take over the centers of power in the city like the Justice Building, the Peacekeepers' headquarters, and the communication center in the square. And at other locations in the district, the railroad, the granary, the power station, and the armory. The night of my engagement, the night Peeta fell to his knee and proclaimed his undying love for me in front of the cameras in the Capitol, was the night the uprising began. It was an ideal cover. Our victory tour interview with Caesar Flickerman was mandatory viewing. It gave the people of District 8 a reason to be out on the streets after dark, gathering either in the square or in various community centers around the city to watch. Ordinarily, such activities would have been too suspicious. Instead, everyone was in place by the appointed hour, 8 o'clock, when the masks went on and all hell broke loose. Taken by surprise and overwhelmed by sheer numbers, the peacekeepers were initially overcome by the crowds. The communication center, the granary, and the power station were all secured. As the peacekeepers fell, weapons were appropriated for the rebels. There was hope that this had not been an act of madness, that in some way, if they could get the word out to other districts, an actual overthrow of the government in the capital might be possible. But then the axe fell. Peacekeepers began to arrive by the thousands. Hovercraft bombed the rebel strongholds into ashes. In the utter chaos that followed, it was all people could do to make it back to their homes alive. It took less than 48 hours to subdue the city. Then, for a week, there was a lockdown. No food, no coal, everyone forbidden to leave their homes. The only time the television showed anything but static was when the suspected instigators were hanged in the square. Then one night, as the whole district was on the brink of starvation, came the order to return to business as usual. That meant school for Twill and Bonnie. A street made impassable by the bombs caused them to be late for their factory shift, so they were still 100 yards away when it exploded, killing everyone inside, including Twill's husband and Bonnie's entire family. Someone must have told the Capitol that the idea for the uprising had started there, Twill tells me faintly. The 2 fled back to Twill's, where the peacekeeper suits were still waiting. They scraped together what provisions they could, stealing freely from neighbors they now knew to be dead, and made it to the railroad station. In a warehouse near the tracks, they changed into the peacekeeper outfits, and disguised, were able to make it onto a boxcar full of fabric on a train headed to District 6.
They fled the train at a fuel stop along the way and traveled on foot. Concealed by woods, but using the tracks for guidance, they made it to the outskirts of District 12 2 days ago, where they were forced to stop when Bonnie twisted her ankle.
I understand why you're running, but what do you expect to find in District 13?
I ask. Bonnie and Twill exchange a nervous glance.
We're not exactly sure, Twill says. It's nothing but rubble, I say. We've all seen the footage.
That's just it.
They've been using the same footage for as long as anyone in District 8 can remember, says Twill.
Really?
I try to think back, to call up the images of 13 I've seen on television.
You know how they always show the Justice Building?
Twill continues. I nod. I've seen it 1,000 times.
If you look very carefully, you'll see it. Up in the far right-hand corner.
See what? I ask.
Twill holds out her cracker with the bird again. A mockingjay. Just a glimpse of it as it flies by. The same one every time.
Back home, we think they keep reusing the old footage because the Capitol can't show what's really there now, says Bonnie.
I give a grunt of disbelief. You're going to District 13 based on that? A shot of a bird? You think you're going to find some new city with people strolling around in it, and that's just fine with the Capitol?
No, Twill says earnestly. We think the people moved underground when everything on the surface was destroyed.
We think they've managed to survive, and we think the Capitol leaves them alone because, before the dark days, District 13's principal industry was nuclear development.
They were graphite miners, I say, but then I hesitate because that's information I got from the Capitol.
They had a few small mines, yes, but not enough to justify a population of that size. That, I guess, is the only thing we know for sure, says Twill.
My heart's beating too quickly. What if they're right? Could it be true? Could there be somewhere to run besides the wilderness? Somewhere safe?
If a community exists in District 13, would it be better to go there, where I might be able to accomplish something instead of waiting here for my death?
But then, if there are people in District 13 with powerful weapons,
why haven't they helped us? I say angrily. If it's true, why do they leave us to live like this? With the hunger and the killings and the games.
And suddenly I hate this imaginary underground city of District 13 and those who sit by, watching us die. They're no better than the Capitol.
We don't know, Bonnie whispers. Right now, we're just holding on to the hope that they exist.
That snaps me to my senses. These are delusions. District 13 doesn't exist because the Capitol would never let it exist. They're probably mistaken about the footage. Mockingjays are about as rare as rocks and about as tough. If they could survive the initial bombing of 13, they're probably doing better than ever now. Bonnie has no home. Her family is dead. Returning to District 8 or assimilating into another district would be impossible. Of course the idea of an independent, thriving District 13 draws her. I can't bring myself to tell her she's chasing a dream as insubstantial as a wisp of smoke. Perhaps she and Twill can carve out a life somehow in the woods. I doubt it, but they're so pitiful I have to try to help. First I give them all the food in my pack, grain and dried beans mostly, but there's enough to hold them for a while if they're careful. Then I take Twill out in the woods and try to explain the basics of hunting. She's got a weapon that, if necessary, can convert solar energy into deadly rays of power, so that could last indefinitely. When she manages to kill her first squirrel, the poor thing is mostly a charred mess because it took a direct hit to the body. But I show her how to skin and clean it. With some practice, she'll figure it out. I cut a new crutch for Bonnie. Back at the house, I peel off an extra layer of socks for the girl telling her to stuff them into the toes of her boots to walk, then wear them on her feet at night. Finally, I teach them how to build a proper fire. They beg me for details of the situation in District 12, and I tell them about life under Thread. I can see that they think this is important information that they'll be bringing to those who run District 13, and I play along so as not to destroy their hopes. But when the light signals late afternoon, I'm out of time to humor them. "I have to go now," I say. They pour out thanks and embrace me. Tears spill from Bonnie's eyes.
"I can't believe we actually got to meet you. You're practically all anyone's talked about since..."
"I know, I know. Since I pulled out those berries," I say, tiredly. I hardly notice the walk home, even though a wet snow begins to fall. My mind is spinning with new information about the uprising in District 8 and the unlikely but tantalizing possibility of District 13. Listening to Bonnie and Twill confirmed one thing. President Snow has been playing me for a fool. All the kisses and endearments in the world couldn't have derailed the momentum building up in District 8. Yes, my holding out the berries had been the spark, but I had no way to control the fire. He must have known that. So why visit my home? Why order me to persuade the crowd of my love for Peter? It was obviously a ploy to distract me and keep me from doing anything else inflammatory in the districts. And to entertain the people in the capital, of course. I suppose the wedding is just a necessary extension of that. I'm nearing the fence when a mockingjay lights on a branch and trills at me. At the sight of it, I realize I never got a full explanation of the bird on the cracker and what it signifies.
"It means we're on your side."
That's what Bonnie said. I have people on my side? What side? Am I unwittingly the face of the hoped-for rebellion? Has the mockingjay on my pin become a symbol of resistance? If so, my side's not doing too well. You only have to look at what happened in District 8 to know that. I stash my weapons in the hollow log nearest my old home in the seam and head for the fence. I'm crouched on one knee, preparing to enter the meadow, but I'm still so preoccupied with the day's events that it takes a sudden screech of an owl to bring me to my senses. In the fading light, the chain links look as innocuous as usual. But what makes me jerk back my hand is the sound, like the buzz of a tree full of tracker-jacker nests, indicating the fence is alive with electricity. Chapter 11. My feet back up automatically and I blend into the trees. I cover my mouth with my glove to disperse the white of my breath in the icy air. Adrenaline courses through me, wiping all the concerns of the day from my mind as I focus on the immediate threat before me. What is going on? Has Thread turned on the fence as an additional security precaution? Or does he somehow know I've escaped his net today? Is he determined to strand me outside District 12 until he can apprehend and arrest me? Drag me to the square to be locked in the stockade, or whipped, or hanged? Calm down, I order myself. It's not as if this is the first time I've been caught outside of the district by an electrified fence. It's happened a few times over the years, but Gale was always with me. The two of us would just pick a comfortable tree to hang out in until the power shut off, which it always did eventually. If I was running late, Prim even got in the habit of going to the meadow to check if the fence was charged to spare my mother worry. But today my family would never imagine I'd be in the woods. I've even taken steps to mislead them. So if I don't show up, worry they will. And there's a part of me that's worried too, because I'm not sure it's just a coincidence, the power coming on the very day I returned to the woods. I thought no one saw me sneak under the fence, but who knows? There are always eyes for hire. Someone reported Gale kissing me in that very spot. Still, that was in daylight, and before I was more careful about my behavior. Could there be surveillance cameras? I've wondered about this before. Is this the way President Snow knows about the kiss? It was dark when I went under, and my face was bundled in a scarf, but the list of suspects likely to be trespassing into the woods is probably very short. My eyes peer through the trees, past the fence, into the meadow. All I can see is the wet snow illuminated here and there by the light from the windows on the edge of the seam. No peacekeepers in sight, no signs I am being hunted. Whether Thread knows I left the district today or not, I realize my course of action must be the same, to get back inside the fence unseen and pretend I never left. Any contact with the chain link or the coils of barbed wire that guard the top would mean instant electrocution. I don't think I can burrow under the fence without risking detection, and the ground's frozen hard anyway. That leaves only one choice. Somehow, I'm going to have to go over it. I begin to skirt along the tree line, searching for a tree with a branch high and long enough to fit my needs. After about a mile, I come upon an old maple that might do. The trunk is too wide and icy to shimmy up, though, and there are no low branches. I climb a neighboring tree and leap precariously into the maple, almost losing my hold on the slick bark. But I manage to get a grip and slowly inch my way out on a limb that hangs above the barbed wire. As I look down, I remember why Gale and I always waited in the woods rather than try to tackle the fence. Being high enough to avoid getting fried means you've got to be at least 20 feet in the air. I guess my branch must be 25. That's a dangerously long drop, even for someone who's had years of practice in trees. But what choice do I have? I could look for another branch, but it's almost dark now. The falling snow will obscure any moonlight. Here, at least, I can see I've got a snowbank to cushion my landing. Even if I could find another, which is doubtful, who knows what I'd be jumping into? I throw my empty game bag around my neck and slowly lower myself until I'm hanging by my hands. For a moment, I gather my courage. Then I release my fingers. There's the sensation of falling. Then I hit the ground with a jolt that goes right up my spine. A second later, my rear end slams the ground. I lie in the snow trying to assess the damage. Without standing, I can tell by the pain in my left heel and my tailbone that I'm injured. The only question is, how badly? I'm hoping for bruises, but when I force myself onto my feet, I suspect I've broken something as well. I can walk, though, so I get moving, trying to hide my limp as best I can. My mother and Prim can't know I was in the woods. I need to work up some sort of alibi, no matter how thin. Some of the shops in the square are still open, so I go in one and purchase white cloth for bandages. We're running low anyway. In another, I buy a bag of sweets for Prim. I stick one of the candies in my mouth, feeling the peppermint melt on my tongue, and realize it's the first thing I've eaten all day. I meant to make a meal at the lake, but once I saw Twill and Bonnie's condition, it seemed wrong to take a single mouthful from them. By the time I reach my house, my left heel will bear no weight at all. I decide to tell my mother I was trying to mend a leak in the roof of our old house and slid off. As for the missing food, I'll just be vague about who I handed it out to. I drag myself in the door, all ready to collapse in front of the fire, but instead, I get another shock. Two peacekeepers, a man and a woman, are standing in the doorway to our kitchen. The woman remains impassive, but I catch the flicker of surprise on the man's face. I am unanticipated. They know I was in the woods and should be trapped there now. "Hello," I say in a neutral voice. My mother appears behind them, but keeps her distance. "Here she is, just in time for dinner," she says a little too brightly. I'm very late for dinner. I consider removing my boots as I normally would, but doubt I can manage it without revealing my injuries. Instead, I just pull off my wet hood and shake the snow from my hair. Can I help you with something? I ask the peacekeepers.
Head Peacekeeper Thread sent us with a message for you, says the woman.
They've been waiting for hours, my mother adds.
They've been waiting for me to fail to return, to confirm I got electrocuted by the fence or trapped in the woods so they could take my family in for questioning.
Must be an important message, I say.
May we ask where you've been, Miss Everdeen? The woman asks.
Easier to ask where I haven't been, I say with a sound of exasperation. I cross into the kitchen, forcing myself to use my foot normally, even though every step is excruciating. I pass between the peacekeepers and make it to the table all right. I fling my bag down and turn to Prim, who's standing stiffly by the hearth. Haymitch and Peeta are there as well, sitting in a pair of matching rockers, playing a game of chess. Were they here by chance, or invited by the peacekeepers? Either way, I'm glad to see them.
So where haven't you been? Says Haymitch in a bored voice.
Well, I haven't been talking to the goat man about getting Prim's goat pregnant, because someone gave me completely inaccurate information as to where he lives, I say to Prim emphatically.
No, I didn't, says Prim. I told you exactly.
You said he lives beside the west entrance to the mine, I say.
The east entrance,
Prim corrects me. You distinctly said the west, because then I said, next to the slag heap, and you said, yeah, I say.
The slag heap next to the east entrance, says Prim patiently.
No, when did you say that? I demand.
Last night, Haymitch chimes in.
It was definitely the east, adds Peeta. He looks at Haymitch and they laugh. I glare at Peeta, and he tries to look contrite.
I'm sorry, but it's what I've been saying. You don't listen when people talk to you.
Bet people told you he didn't live there today, and you didn't listen again, says Haymitch.
Shut up, Haymitch, I say, clearly indicating he's right. Haymitch and Peeta crack up, and Prim allows herself a smile.
Fine. Somebody else can arrange to get the stupid goat knocked up, I say, which makes them laugh more. And I think, this is why they've made it this far, Haymitch and Peeta. Nothing throws them. I look at the peacekeepers. The man's smiling, but the woman is unconvinced.
What's in the bag? She asks sharply. I know she's hoping for game or wild plants. Something that clearly condemns me. I dump the contents on the table.
See for yourself.
Oh, good, says my mother, examining the cloth. We're running low on bandages.
Peeta comes to the table and opens the candy bag.
Ooh, peppermints, he says, popping one in his mouth.
They're mine. I take a swipe for the bag. He tosses it to Haymitch, who stuffs a fistful of sweets in his mouth before passing the bag to a giggling Prim.
None of you deserves candy, I say.
What, because we're right?
Peeta wraps his arms around me. I give a small yelp of pain as my tailbone objects. I try to turn it into a sound of indignation, but I can see in his eyes that he knows I'm hurt.
Okay, Prim said west. I distinctly heard west. And we're all idiots. How's that?
Better, I say, and accept his kiss. Then I look at the peacekeepers as if suddenly remembering they're there.
You have a message for me?
From the head peacekeeper Thread, says the woman. He wanted you to know that the fence surrounding District 12 will now have electricity 24 hours a day.
Didn't it already?
I ask, a little too innocently.
He thought you might be interested in passing this information on to your cousin,
says the woman.
Thank you. I'll tell him.
I'm sure we'll all sleep a little more soundly now that security has addressed that lapse. I'm pushing things, I know it, but the comment gives me a sense of satisfaction. The woman's jaw tightens. None of this has gone as planned, but she has no further orders. She gives me a curt nod and leaves, the man trailing in her wake. When my mother has locked the door behind them, I slump against the table. "What is it?" says Peter, holding me steadily.
"Oh, I banged up my left foot, the heel, and my tailbone's had a bad day, too." He helps me over to one of the rockers, and I lower myself onto the padded cushion. My mother eases off my boots.
"What happened?"
"I slipped and fell," I say.
Four pairs of eyes look at me with disbelief.
"On some ice.
But we all know the house must be bugged, and it's not safe to talk openly. Not here, not now." Having stripped off my sock, my mother's fingers probe the bones in my left heel, and I wince.
"There might be a break," she says. She checks the other foot. "This one seems all right."
She judges my tailbone to be badly bruised. Prim's dispatched to get my pajamas and robe. When I'm changed, my mother makes a snowpack for my left heel and props it up on a hassock. I eat three bowls of stew and half a loaf of bread while the others dine at the table. I stare at the fire, thinking of Bonnie and Twill, hoping that the heavy, wet snow has erased my tracks. Prim comes and sits on the floor next to me, leaning her head against my knee. We suck on peppermints as I brush her soft, blonde hair back behind her ear.
"How was school?" I ask.
"All right. We learned about coal byproducts," she says.
We stare at the fire for a while.
"Are you going to try on your wedding dresses?"
"Not tonight. Tomorrow, probably," I say.
"Wait until I get home, okay?"
she says.
"Sure,
if they don't arrest me first." My mother gives me a cup of chamomile tea with a dose of sleep syrup, and my eyelids begin to droop immediately. She wraps my bad foot, and Peter volunteers to get me to bed. I start out by leaning on his shoulder, but I'm so wobbly he just scoops me up and carries me upstairs. He tucks me in and says goodnight, but I catch his hand and hold him there. A side effect of the sleep syrup is that it makes people less inhibited, like white liquor, and I know I have to control my tongue. But I don't want him to go. In fact, I want him to climb in with me, to be there when the nightmares hit tonight. For some reason that I can't quite form, I know I'm not allowed to ask that.
"Don't go yet, not until I fall asleep," I say.
Peter sits on the side of the bed, warming my hand in both of his.
"Almost thought you'd changed your mind today, when you were late for dinner."
I'm foggy, but I can guess what he means. With the fence going on and me showing up late and the peacekeepers waiting, he thought I'd made a run for it, maybe with Gail.
"No, I'd have told you," I say.
I pull his hand up and lean my cheek against the back of it, taking in the faint scent of cinnamon and dill from the breads he must have baked today. I want to tell him about Twill and Bonnie and the uprising and the fantasy of District 13, but it's not safe to, and I can feel myself slipping away, so I just get out one more sentence.
"Stay with me."
As the tendrils of sleep syrup pull me down, I hear him whisper a word back, but I don't quite catch it. My mother lets me sleep until noon, then rouses me to examine my heel. I'm ordered to a week of bed rest, and I don't object because I feel so lousy. Not just my heel and my tailbone. My whole body aches with exhaustion. So I let my mother doctor me and feed me breakfast in bed and tuck another quilt around me. Then I just lie there, staring out my window at the winter sky, pondering how on earth this will all turn out. I think a lot about Bonnie and Twill and the pile of white wedding dresses downstairs, and if Thread will figure out how I got back in and arrest me. It's funny, because he could just arrest me anyway based on past crimes. But maybe he has to have something really irrefutable to do it now that I'm a victor. And I wonder if President Snow's in contact with Thread. I think it's unlikely he ever acknowledged that old Cray existed, but now that I'm such a nationwide problem, is he carefully instructing Thread what to do, or is Thread acting on his own? At any rate, I'm sure they'd both agree on keeping me locked up here inside the district with that fence. Even if I could figure out some way to escape, maybe get a rope up to that maple tree branch and climb out, there'd be no escaping with my family and friends now. I told Gale I would stay and fight anyway. For the next few days, I jump every time there's a knock on the door. No peacekeepers show up to arrest me, though, so eventually I begin to relax. I'm further reassured when Peeta casually tells me the power is off in sections of the fence because crews are out securing the base of the chain link to the ground. Thread must believe I somehow got under the thing, even with that deadly current running through it. It's a break for the district, having the peacekeepers busy doing something besides abusing people. Peeta comes by every day to bring me cheese buns and begins to help me work on the family book. It's an old thing, made of parchment and leather. Some herbalist on my mother's side of the family started it ages ago. The book's composed of page after page of ink drawings of plants with descriptions of their medical uses. My father added a section on edible plants that was my guidebook to keeping us alive after his death. For a long time, I've wanted to record my own knowledge in it. Things I learned from experience or from Gale, and then the information I picked up when I was training for the games. I didn't because I'm no artist, and it's so crucial that the pictures are drawn in exact detail. That's where Peeta comes in. Some of the plants he knows already, others we have dried samples of, and others I have to describe. He makes sketches on scrap paper until I'm satisfied they're right, then I let him draw them in the book. After that, I carefully print all I know about the plant. It's quiet, absorbing work that helps take my mind off my troubles. I like to watch his hands as he works, making a blank page bloom with strokes of ink, adding touches of color to our previously black and yellowish book. His face takes on a special look when he concentrates. His usual easy expression is replaced by something more intense and removed that suggests an entire world locked away inside him. I've seen flashes of this before, in the arena, or when he speaks to a crowd, or that time he shoved the peacekeeper's guns away from me in District 11. I don't know quite what to make of it. I also become a little fixated on his eyelashes, which ordinarily you don't notice much because they're so blonde. But up close, in the sunlight slanting in from the window, they're a light golden color and so long, I don't see how they keep from getting all tangled up when he blinks. One afternoon, Peeta stops shading a blossom and looks up so suddenly that I start, as though I were caught spying on him, which in a strange way, maybe I was. But he only says, "You know, I think this is the first time we've ever done anything normal together." "Yeah," I agree. Our whole relationship has been tainted by the games. Normal was never a part of it. Nice for a change. Each afternoon he carries me downstairs for a change of scenery, and I unnerve everyone by turning on the television. Usually we only watch when it's mandatory, because the mixture of propaganda and displays of the capital's power, including clips from the 74 years of Hunger Games, is so odious. But now I'm looking for something special, the mockingjay that Bonnie and Twill are basing all their hopes on. I know it's probably foolishness, but if it is, I want to rule it out. And erase the idea of a thriving District 13 from my mind for good. My first sighting is in a news story referencing the dark days. I see the smoldering remains of the Justice Building in District 13 and just catch the black and white underside of a mockingjay's wing as it flies across the upper right-hand corner. That doesn't prove anything, really. It's just an old shot that goes with an old tale. However, several days later, something else grabs my attention. The main newscaster is reading a piece about a shortage of graphite affecting the manufacturing of items in District 3. They cut to what is supposed to be live footage of a female reporter encased in a protective suit standing in front of the ruins of the Justice Building in 13. Through her mask, she reports that unfortunately a study has just today determined that the mines of District 13 are still too toxic to approach. End of story. But just before they cut back to the main newscaster, I see the unmistakable flash of that same mockingjay's wing. The reporter has simply been incorporated into the old footage. She's not in District 13 at all, which begs the question, what is? Chapter 12. Staying quietly in bed is harder after that. I want to be doing something, finding out more about District 13, or helping in the cause to bring down the Capitol. Instead, I sit around stuffing myself with cheese buns and watching Peeta sketch. Haymitch stops by occasionally to bring me news from town, which is always bad. More people being punished or dropping from starvation. Winter has begun to withdraw by the time my foot is deemed usable. My mother gives me exercises to do and lets me walk on my own a bit. I go to sleep one night, determined to go into town the next morning, but I wake to find Venia, Octavia, and Flavius grinning down at me.
"Surprise!" they squeal. "We're here early!"
After I took that lash in the face, Haymitch got their visit pushed back several months so I could heal up. I wasn't expecting them for another 3 weeks, but I try to act delighted that my bridal photo shoot is here at last. My mother hung up all the dresses, so they're ready to go, but to be honest, I haven't even tried one on. After the usual histrionics about the deteriorated state of my beauty, they get right down to business. Their biggest concern is my face, although I think my mother did a pretty remarkable job healing it. There's just a pale pink strip across my cheekbone. The whipping's not common knowledge, so I tell them I slipped on the ice and cut it, and then I realize that's my same excuse for hurting my foot, which is going to make walking in high heels a problem. But Flavius, Octavia, and Venia aren't the suspicious types, so I'm safe there. Since I only have to look hairless for a few hours instead of several weeks, I get to be shaved instead of waxed. I still have to soak in a tub of something, but it isn't vile, and we're on to my hair and makeup before I know it. The team, as usual, is full of news, which I usually do my best to tune out. But then Octavia makes a comment that catches my attention. It's a passing remark, really, about how she couldn't get shrimp for a party, but it tugs at me. "Why couldn't you get shrimp? Is it out of season?" I ask.
"Oh, Katniss, we haven't been able to get any seafood for weeks," says Octavia. "You know, because the weather's been so bad in District 4.
My mind starts buzzing. No seafood for weeks from District 4. The barely concealed rage in the crowd during the victory tour. And suddenly I am absolutely sure that District 4 has revolted. I begin to question them casually about what other hardships this winter has brought them. They are not used to want, so any little disruption in supply makes an impact on them. By the time I'm ready to be dressed, their complaints about the difficulty of getting different products, from crab meat to music chips to ribbons, has given me a sense of which districts might actually be rebelling. Seafood from District 4, electronic gadgets from District 3, and of course, fabrics from District 8. The thought of such widespread rebellion has me quivering with fear and excitement. I want to ask them more, but Cinna appears to give me a hug and check my makeup. His attention goes right to the scar on my cheek. Somehow I don't think he believes the slipping on the ice story, but he doesn't question it. He simply adjusts the powder on my face, and what little you can see of the lash mark vanishes. Downstairs, the living room has been cleared and lit for the photo shoot. Effie's having a fine time ordering everybody around, keeping us all on schedule. It's probably a good thing, because there are 6 gowns, and each one requires its own headpiece, shoes, jewelry, hair, makeup, setting, and lighting. Creamy lace and pink roses and ringlets. Ivory satin and gold tattoos and greenery. A sheath of diamonds and jeweled veil and moonlight. Heavy white silk and sleeves that fall from my wrist to the floor and pearls. The moment one shot has been approved, we move right into preparing for the next. I feel like dough being kneaded and reshaped again and again. My mother manages to feed me bits of food and sips of tea while they work on me. But by the time the shoot is over, I'm starving and exhausted. I'm hoping to spend some time with Cinna now, but Effie whisks everybody out the door, and I have to make do with the promise of a phone call. Evening has fallen, and my foot hurts from all the crazy shoes, so I abandon any thoughts of going into town. Instead, I go upstairs and wash away the layers of makeup and conditioners and dyes, and then go down to dry my hair by the fire. Prim, who came home from school in time to see the last 2 dresses, chatters on about them with my mother. They both seem overly happy about the photo shoot. When I fall into bed, I realize it's because they think it means I'm safe, that the Capitol has overlooked my interference with the whipping, since no one is going to go to such trouble and expense for someone they plan on killing anyway, right? In my nightmare, I'm dressed in the silk bridal gown, but it's torn and muddy. The long sleeves keep getting caught on thorns and branches as I run through the woods. The pack of mutation tributes draws closer and closer until it overcomes me with hot breath and dripping fangs, and I scream myself awake. It's too close to dawn to bother trying to get back to sleep. Besides, today I really have to get out and talk to someone. Gail will be unreachable in the mines, but I need Haymitch or Peter or somebody to share the burden of all that has happened to me since I went to the lake. Fleeing outlaws, electrified fences, an independent District 13, shortages in the capital, everything. I eat breakfast with my mother and Prim and head out in search of a confidant. The air's warm, with hopeful hints of spring in it. Spring would be a good time for an uprising, I think. Everyone feels less vulnerable once winter passes. Peter's not home. I guess he's already gone into town. I'm surprised to see Haymitch moving around his kitchen so early, though. I walk into his house without knocking. I can hear Hazel upstairs, sweeping the floors of the now spotless house. Haymitch isn't flat-out drunk, but he doesn't look too steady either. I guess the rumors about Ripper being back in business are true. I'm thinking maybe I better let him just go to bed, when he suggests a walk to town. Haymitch and I can speak in a kind of shorthand now. In a few minutes, I've updated him, and he's told me about the rumors of uprisings in District 7 and 11 as well. If my hunches are right, this would mean almost half the districts have at least attempted to rebel. "Do you still think it won't work here?" I ask.
"Not yet.
Those other districts, they're much larger. Even if half the people cower in their homes, the rebels stand a chance. Here in 12, it's got to be all of us or nothing, he says.
I hadn't thought of that, how we lack strength of numbers. But maybe at some point, I insist.
Maybe. But we're small, we're weak, and we don't develop nuclear weapons, says Haymitch with a touch of sarcasm.
He didn't get too excited over my District 13 story. What do you think they'll do, Haymitch? To the districts that are rebelling, I ask.
Well, you've heard what they did in 8. You've seen what they did here, and that was without provocation, says Haymitch. If things really do get out of hand, I think they'll have no problem killing off another district, same as they did 13. Make an example of it, you know?
So you think 13 is really destroyed? I mean, Bonnie and Twill were right about the footage of the Mockingjay, I say.
Okay, but what does that prove?
Nothing, really. There are plenty of reasons they could be using old footage.
Probably it looks more impressive, and it's a lot simpler, isn't it, to just press a few buttons in the editing room than to fly all the way out there and film it, he says. The idea that 13 has somehow rebounded and the Capitol is ignoring it? That sounds like the kind of rumor desperate people cling to.
I know. I was just hoping, I say.
Exactly, because you're desperate, says Haymitch.
I don't argue because, of course, he's right. Prim comes home from school, bubbling over with excitement. The teachers announced there was mandatory programming tonight.
I think it's going to be your photo shoot.
It can't be, Prim. They only did the pictures yesterday, I tell her.
Well, that's what somebody heard, she says.
I'm hoping she's wrong. I haven't had time to prepare Gail for any of this. Since the whipping, I only see him when he comes to the house for my mother to check how he's healing. He's often scheduled 7 days a week in the mine. In the few minutes of privacy we've had, with me walking him back to town, I gather that the rumblings of an uprising in 12 have been subdued by Thread's crackdown. He knows I'm not going to run. But he must also know that if we don't revolt in 12, I'm destined to be Peter's bride. Seeing me lounging around in gorgeous gowns on his television, what can he do with that? When we gather around the television at 7:30, I discover that Prim is right. Sure enough, there's Caesar Flickerman, speaking before a standing-room-only crowd in front of the training center, talking to an appreciative crowd about my upcoming nuptials. He introduces Cinna, who became an overnight star with his costumes for me in the games, and after a minute of good-natured chit-chat, we are directed to turn our attention to a giant screen. I see now how they could photograph me yesterday and present the special tonight. Initially, Cinna designed 24 wedding gowns. Since then, there's been the process of narrowing down the designs, creating the dresses, and choosing the accessories. Apparently, in the Capitol, there were opportunities to vote for your favorite at each stage. This is all culminating with shots of me in the final 6 dresses, which I'm sure took no time at all to insert in the show. Each shot is met with a huge reaction from the crowd. People screaming and cheering for their favorites, booing the ones they don't like. Having voted and probably bet on the winner, people are very invested in my wedding gown. It's bizarre to watch when I think how I never even bothered to try one on before the cameras arrived. Caesar announces that interested parties must cast their final vote by noon on the following day.
"Let's get Katniss Everdeen to her wedding in style," he hollers to the crowd.
I'm about to shut off the television, but then Caesar is telling us to stay tuned for the other big event of the evening.
"That's right. This year will be the 75th anniversary of the Hunger Games, and that means it's time for our third quarter quell!"
"What will they do?" asks Prim. "It isn't for months yet."
We turn to our mother, whose expression is solemn and distant, as if she's remembering something. Must be the reading of the card.